Hello, and welcome to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. My name's Craig Barker, I'm the Head of Public Engagement, and in this podcast series, we explore with our special guest each episode their personal relationship with an object or a series of objects within the collection of the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney. This episode, I'm really, really excited to be joined by one of my colleagues at the museum, a registration officer, Damien Stone. As well as working with a collection management team, Damien is also an archaeologist and an author. And what we're going to be doing today is Damien and I are going to be delving back into the ancient Middle East. So firstly, welcome Damien. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Craig.
So first up, could you begin by speaking about your background and your interests, your personal interests?
Sure. So as you said, I'm a registration officer. I work behind the scenes in the Chow Chak Wing Museum storerooms, registering objects and performing audits of our collections. I work on a lot of different data projects, making sure information about museum objects is captured and is accessible. And I came to enter the world of museums after studying archaeology here at Sydney University and doing some volunteer work with the Nicholson Museum when it resided in its old home tucked inside the quadrangle. As you said, I still research and write on the ancient world as a bit of a side gig. I wrote a book on the cultural history of the pomegranate a few years ago.
I know you're very modest, but I'm going to jump in and say it's a brilliant book. So I'm going to recommend our listeners go out and hunt it.
Oh, cheers. Thank you so much. What drew me to pomegranates is that they're delicious, and they've been used as such a potent fertility symbol from antiquity until today. And I'm currently working on a second project to do with Bronze Age civilization in Asia Minor.
And this is the Hittites in particular.
Yes, the Hittites is what I'm focused on.
So given you've got that wide background of interest in ancient Mediterranean cultures and ancient Middle Eastern cultures, what object from the Chow Chak Wing Museum, and of course we have a very large holding of archaeological material from that part of the world,
yes, but
what item have you chosen to discuss today in this episode?
Today I want to talk about an example in our collection of one of my favourite types of artefact, the cylinder seal. These are small stone cylinders that are engraved with encircling decoration. They are essentially roller stamps, which were carved in negative, and when rolled across a wet clay surface, a positive impression will be created of the miniature artworks that are carved upon them. And this seal in particular, which is NM52.54, is 2 centimetres high and made from a brownish black stone known as gauthite.
Now, I'm going to ask you more about how the impressions were used and how widely distributed they were as we go along. So, Damien, one of the really interesting things about cylinder seals is, of course, the scenes that are depicted on that impression when they're rolled out.
Yes.
In terms of this particular one we're talking about today, NM52.54, what's the scene on it? What can we actually see?
So, on the seal, you can see the depiction of a figure who, they could either be a person or a god, and he is processing towards the left amidst a group of creatures. There are 2 sphinxes on a lower register, and they are topped by what looks like a lion and a bird of prey with outstretched wings. This design is very much of a style particular to the Syria-Levant region and dates from the late Bronze Age, probably manufactured in the 14th or the 13th century BC.
Okay, so we've got a framework in which this one will fit.
Yes.
More generally, I mean, there are thousands, tens of thousands of cylinder seals in museum collections around the world. What are some of the scenes we do get more generally?
Very common are presentation scenes in which you see people being presented before the gods, or combat scenes in which men combat with animals. Lots of these that resemble scenes from the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Mm.
So they're 2 very common types of depictions. But one seal that has received a lot of attention in the British Museum shows all the Mesopotamian gods with their respective attributes. You've got sun god Shamash holding his sword that he uses to slice through the mountains and rise at dawn. You've got Ishtar with wings and weapons coming out of her shoulders because she's a god of war and love. And this other god named Enki, who's the god of of sweet water, and he's shown with streams of water coming out of his shoulders and with little fish swimming down. Yeah, it's a wonderful seal.
It's really interesting, isn't it? As we see in other art forms from other, you know, from a range of cultures in the ancient Middle Eastern world, but that relationship between the decoration and the functionality too is really interesting.
Yes.
But bringing it back to the Nicholson Collection Chow Chak Wing Museum seal, I mean, it's also interesting as you describe it that it's very abstract in some way, isn't it? The design.
Yeah.
Any comments upon how you respond to seeing those scenes?
Yes, you get abstract scenes that often show arranged symbols, or you get these kind of common scenes that I mentioned before, like the presentation before a god or combat scenes that I was mentioning.
So in terms of the one we're focusing on today, how did this seal end up in the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection? Do we know anything about its provenance and where it came from?
We have a little bit. So the seal was purchased by the Nicholson Museum in the 1950s from Dr. Morris Lazerson, alongside five other cylinder seals. Lazerson was a Russian lawyer, a minister in the Kerensky government, and a Russian emissary in Germany. Unfortunately, though, it's not really known how he acquired the seals.
Mm. So, I mean, okay, so we don't have an archaeological provenance in the more traditional sense. So, you know, you mentioned before its similarities with styles from the Syria Levantine region of about the 14th or 13th century.
Mm-hmm.
Is that really the only framework we have in terms of trying to work out its date and its origin is based upon its
stylistic
style?
Stylistic grounds, yes.
Okay. So you talked right at the very beginning about the process of the impression being rolled out. Let's talk more about how cylinder seals actually operated. Firstly, just from a practical perspective, how did you roll it out and what you were rolling it onto? But I guess then more broadly, what do cylinder seals, given they're so ubiquitous, what do they tell us about ancient Middle Eastern societies?
So cylinder seals are very common in this part of the world. They're a distinctive artifact used by lots of different cultures in the ancient Near East. They developed alongside the invention of cuneiform writing in Mesopotamia in the 4th millennium BC. And what they were essentially used for is identification. So they marked ownership.
So each person had their own seal.
Yeah. Yeah. They acted as a kind of personal signature
on
documents, written on clay tablets, and also as a form of security as well, used to seal doors or storage vessels. So you put down a blob of clay and then roll your seal across it to indicate if your goods have been tampered with. I should note that seals could also be of stamp form that was pressed down rather than a cylinder that was rolled across continuously.
So it's interesting, archaeologically we can get both the preservation of the seal itself, but then we can also get the preservation of the seal impression. Yeah.
The seal impression is known as a sealing, when you have the surviving seal impression on a bit of clay. Yeah.
And they could also double as jewellery?
Yes. So seals were definitely used as jewellery. This seal has been perforated through the center so that it could be strung through and worn by its original owner on the wrist or around the neck or perhaps even as a ring. And what I love about seals is that they become an embodiment of their owner's identity. It's a device that's both practical and symbolic. These little objects that sealed and protected an owner's goods were regarded as amulets, likewise capable of protecting their owner's body. A particularly nasty Mesopotamian demon named Lamashtu, who preyed on pregnant women and young children, was said to be repelled by the wearing of a seal.
Right, fascinating.
And it should come as no surprise then that to lose your cylinder seal was considered a really bad omen.
I bet it was.
Yes, there was always the potential that this could lead to the carrying out of fraudulent transactions that were made in your name. And there are some surviving Sumerian and Babylonian records that are lists of the names of some sad individuals alongside the date they lost their seals.
It's interesting. I mean, I've been looking at cylinder seals in archaeological museums around the globe for 2 decades now, but they're really ID cards, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah. I had my passport stolen in a robbery several years ago, so I can totally sympathise with these poor people who have essentially lost their ID.
Mm.
It was a traumatic experience.
Do we get the names of the owners on the seals then, if they've really got that sense of personal connection?
So some seals have cuneiform inscriptions that identify the names of their owners, but as in our example, this was not a necessary element.
Right.
Used by a wide range of society, lots of seal users were likely illiterate and using them for everyday transactions and the securing of their property. Even deities had their own seals.
Mm.
Ritual texts described them as being made of gold and hung around the necks of their cult statues. There's this delightful scene in a Hittite myth where the gods go to their divine storehouse. They break the impressed sealing that secures the door, retrieve some sacred implements thereafter, and then they seal it up again with their ancestral seal.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's extraordinary. Yeah. So we've already spoken about how the Chowchak Wing Museum example is made from stone. Mm-hmm. What are seals commonly made from? What are the range of materials that were being used by the craftspeople who were creating them?
Yeah. So seals are most often carved from semi-precious stones like lapis lazuli or carnelian. Our example, as I said before, is gauthite. But even more modest examples survive that are made of clay.
Do we know if wood was ever used? I mean, obviously it won't survive in the archaeological record, but are there...
I would say it was probably used, but yes, you're right, won't survive it. I don't know of any wooden examples. But choosing the right material used seems to have been just as important as the choice of the iconography engraved upon it. There is this Mesopotamian text that I might quote from here that refers to a kind of horoscope that seals made from various stones bestowed certain qualities upon their owner. A seal of lapis lazuli portends that he shall have power. His god shall rejoice over him. A seal of crystal portends that he shall enlarge his profits. His name shall be good. A seal of Zatu Udash portends that he shall walk in joy of heart. A seal of green marble portends that until he comes to the grave, favour upon favour shall be bestowed upon him. Now, before you ask, we don't really know what stone Zatu Udash refers to.
Oh.
Maybe it's gautha, like our example. Yeah. I mean, this seal here certainly makes me feel a lot of joy in my heart.
I'd quite like a green marble. Yeah. Have favour upon favour until the grave. But that's great. That is great. So, I mean, it's really interesting, just that personal aspect that it's such a way of reaching out to an individual from thousands of years ago that we're not going to be able to know otherwise.
Mm.
Yeah, yes. Extraordinary. So, how does this particular seal then relate to your own interests? Why did you decide to choose it today of all of the objects from the collection that fall under your archaeological interests? What drove you to choose this item?
So, as I said before, I love seals, but what drew me to it is that this seal dates between 1450 and 1200 BC, which is an era that I find absolutely fascinating. It's the Late Bronze Age. And during this time, there was a lot of diplomacy between the major civilizations around in West Asia and the Mediterranean. Royal seals of the time were certainly getting a lot of use, being frantically stamped and rolled across letters that were exchanged between kings of the great powers like the Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Hittites, and the Mitanni. And this is best attested from an archive of cuneiform tablets discovered at Akhenaten's capital of Amarna, the so-called Amarna letters.
Now, it's worthwhile mentioning that within our Egyptian collection, we have a fair amount of material from Amarna when it was excavated by the Egyptian Exploration Society back in the 1920s. So this really quite fascinating mixture across the collections that two different cultures get, they're still interweaving. A lot of the Cypriot materials, Late Bronze Age as well, too. Yeah. So we've got a lot of different things in the same museum that are indirectly related but are related. Mm. This is really quite fascinating, isn't it?
It is. It really is.
So what do we see in the Amarna letters?
There are a series of letters between the great kings of the period that record the exchange of gifts, diplomatic marriages, and quarrels between these competing civilizations. One of the most memorable figures to emerge in the letters is Tushratta. He was a king of the Mitanni, which were a Hurrian-speaking state based in northern Iraq and Syria.
Yep. So the area of Kurdistan now.
In a favourite letter of mine, he complains to the pharaoh that he has been sent two gold-plated statues when he was expecting a pair of solid gold ones. Tushratta requests that next time Egypt should send him much gold, for he believes that in Egypt gold is as plentiful as dirt. Yeah. In this age,
this is kind of the equivalent of the release of personal texts between world leaders today, isn't it? You get a real the conversations that we're otherwise not privy to.
So, in this age of diplomacy, kings addressed each other as brothers. In one document, a Hittite king rejects such formalities when writing a letter to the king of Assyria and writes, "On what account should I write to you about brotherhood? Were you and I born of the same mother?" And it's these kind of personalities that shine through that are the reason that I love reading these ancient texts.
Mm. Again, it's really insightful too that, you know, the pharaohs and the various kings and so on, who we may know from sculpture and other adornments, but suddenly they're as human as we are.
Yeah, we're hearing their written word.
So the seal itself, coming from the Levantine region of modern-day Syria, it's quite an important area then, given that you've got these two major world powers playing off in a cold war that's entered into a hard war, aren't we?
Yeah. So the Syria-Levant region from which our seal comes became the point of contestation between two of these great ancient global powers. Both the Hittites and the Egyptians occupied part of the area. Territorial disputes escalated and resulted in a famous battle between the two powers in 1274 at a place called Kadesh.
Yep.
The aftermath of the battle saw the composition of what is regarded as the world's first peace treaty.
Mm.
The Hittite and the Egyptian version have survived, which is really awesome and quite rare. It doesn't happen very often.
No, not at all.
The pharaoh had it proudly carved on several temples at Karnak in hieroglyphs, whilst a clay tablet excavated at the Hittite capital of Hattusha preserves the cuneiform version.
And we still can see it today, can't we? Because it's ended up having an unusual second life.
An enlarged facsimile of this cuneiform tablet actually hangs in the United Nations, given as a gift by the government of Turkey to the UN in the 1970s.
Fascinating.
Yeah. But returning to the seal, its iconography reflects upon this international age from which it originates. The motif of the Sphinx has its origins as a symbol of kingship in Egypt, but came to be adopted by many of these ancient cultures. Lions and eagles were likewise valued by many of these Bronze Age civilizations. A text describes a Hittite king named Hattusili I as having the teeth of a lion and the eyes of the eagle.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like to think that the person who once owned our little cylinder seal, whilst not one of these great kings, was making a very deliberate choice in the design, a kind of generic image of themselves surrounded by these powerful animals.
Yeah.
The lion, the bird of prey, the sphinxes, they may have represented traits of these creatures like strength and keen-sightedness that were admired. For the seal's owners, these little apotropaic animals were capable of preventing evil forces inflicted upon their written word, on their property, or on their body.
It's really interesting too, isn't it, that sense of the use of animals as symbols for who you are. And obviously we know it and understand it from a propagandistic perspective on a political level, with the great leaders representing themselves as, you know, lions and or hunters of lions even more so. But to see it infiltrate into society far more broadly too is interesting.
It really is, yeah.
That, you know, you knew when you got the letter with this seal with the lion on it that the person sending you the letter was to be taken seriously.
Yes. Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So now look, one thing that anyone who's appeared on the podcast or anyone who's listened to the podcast will be aware, the question I ask everybody is, in one word, any word that you can choose from the English language, what does the seal signify for you?
The one word I think is appropriate to close with is impression. Yeah. This seal was used to leave an impression on clay in antiquity, and it equally makes an impression on people who look upon it today.
Yeah, you're right.
I'd like people who look at the seal to think about identity, that this little object was a symbol of the self for a human being who lived over 3,000 years ago. It would have been integral in the daily transactions of this original owner.
It's amazing to think that it's often the smallest things we leave behind that are the most meaningful.
It's true.
Damien, thank you very much for taking us on the journey. Good luck with the book. Can't wait to read.
Thank you so much.
It's been an absolute pleasure spending time with you exploring this cylinder seal. Yeah. Is it on display at the moment?
It is not on display at the moment, but hopefully one day.
We can work on the curators.
Yeah.
Thank you for your time, Damien.
Thank you so much, Craig.
Object Matters is recorded on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The Chow Chak Wing Museum and the University of Sydney wishes to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands and the care and custodianship that they have shown.
Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app, and connect with the Chow Chak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, News Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.